Welcome to Out of the Question, a podcast that looks behind some common questions and uncovers the question behind the question while providing real solutions for biblical world and life view. Your host is Andrea Schwartz, a teacher and mentor and founder of the Chalcedon Teacher Training Institute.
California at one time was known for great weather, great agriculture, and the place people wanted to come. Not so much anymore. It has been the scene of massive migration out of the state as a result of a political system that is anything but conducive to families, businesses, and good sense. Yearly, the California legislature proposes bills that would seriously hurt individuals and families, especially those that consider that the state should not be God walking on earth. As a result of this, Family Protection Ministries was begun in 1986 by Roy Hansen as an organization dedicated to researching and combating such legislations and informing people in order to take early action. They were the watchmen on the wall. There have been significant victories over the years. When Roy Hansen retired, Family Protection Ministries was placed in the hands of Nathan Pierce, who had worked with Roy over the years, Nathan himself being a homeschool graduate, and he has been in this role since 2002. I've interviewed Nathan before. My regular listeners might remember that in 2021, in podcast number 150, I asked him the question, who is protecting the family? Now, I advise people to go and listen to that because there's good information in that conversation that won't necessarily be repeated here, but it's worth knowing about. So I've asked him to come back to unpack the continuous bombardment of anti-family, anti-Christian legislative bills that pour out of the Golden State each year. Nathan, thanks for joining me today in the midst of a very busy schedule.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Now, in our last conversation, you pointed out that whereas Family Protection Ministries had as its focus the effects of legislation on homeschooling families, you explained that you had to broaden your areas of concern because sometimes these sneaky people throw things into the middle of bills that will, by implication, could affect homeschooling families. Now, recently in California, two such bills have been proposed. And whereas they weren't necessarily geared towards, you know, they didn't have their sights on homeschooling families, FPM was able to say, but it could. And on top of it all, that they're very anti-Christian in nature. So most people who listen to this podcast probably do not reside in California. So if you could give a little bit of background on the charter school bill and then AB 495, because as the saying goes, what happens in California often drifts east.
Sure. So starting with AB 84, the charter school bill, this bill is just sort of what I call the latest in a long line of new restrictions on what was once a very different education structure than we see today in California charter schools. California charter schools were started back in 1992 to create sort of a locally run mom and pop style school that was funded by the California state government. Still government funded, still technically public schools, but it was supposed to be this local controlled parent and community leader started education program. And that went on, and year after year, we saw more and more restriction on what that looked like to make it more every day, more like the traditional campus public schools that we all know. And so this AB 84 is the latest restriction on that. And it really goes after two things. One is the issue of where is the money going and is it being used for what we said that it was supposed to be getting used for, which that by itself is something that has been changing quite a bit over the years because they want to keep tightening down where their money goes. You know, it's reasonable to set parameters for where the money's going and make sure that it gets used that way and not misused. And there's a lot of misuse of government funds in charter schools, so they're trying to crack down on certain aspects of that. The other part of the bill actually goes after what we often refer to as teachers or tutors or vendors, people that get paid by charter school funds, and they have to be certified by the state as a vendor, a qualified vendor, to be allowed to be paid by a charter school as a teacher or tutor. And so the way that AB 84 was going to go about this originally was to say, no, every single vendor has to be a certified teacher, which is even more strict than what the traditional public campus schools have, because there's a whole bunch of teachers in the traditional public schools that are not certified teachers. And that has come about largely by sort of the crisis that California is in with the teacher shortage. And emergency after emergency situation comes up where we need more teachers, so let's just sign a whole bunch of people in under this emergency provision. And so they didn't like how many people were teaching young people in through this charter school provision. And so they wanted to tighten up on that and make it so that if you wanted to teach kids that were enrolled in a charter school, you have to be a certified teacher. Now, this is all kind of coming from this idea of, well, if the traditional public schools are losing students, which they are, in a couple of different ways. You mentioned people leaving California. That's definitely a thing still. And traditional public schools are very concerned about that. In fact, there have been a number of articles about that over the last couple of years. In LA Times, for example, that the schools are concerned about this terrible thing that's happening of kids leaving the schools. And so the California Teachers Association, or CTA, is very aware of this problem, and they are one of the most powerful lobbying organizations in California. They have a ton of money, and they go after anything that would weaken their position in California. Their position is strong when public schools are strong. Their position is strong when their teachers, certified teachers that are members of the teachers union, are in high demand. And so when you have this charter school system that is paying teachers that are not certified and not part of the teachers union, and those vendors, certified vendors, however they get certified, they're not part of the CTA necessarily, and they're not necessarily, and in most cases, are not certified teachers, that explosion of that universe of education has really undermined the strength of the position of the California Teachers Association.
All right. So I have read up on this, and it pointed out that charter school teachers make less, by and large, than the traditional public school. And so the attack here is on the amount of funding that already for people to take a job at a charter school, they're getting less than quote unquote market value. So are they just trying to defund charter schools out of existence?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it. Yep, I think that's honestly the bottom line here. And they're one of the things that they do is they are really good at, I've seen CTA do this as well as other organizations, when they're lobbying, they're willing to take a big bite with a big bill that goes after a bunch of things, and then they scale it back when there's opposition so that they can get a smaller portion of that bill passed through. I talk about people taking 10 steps forward and then 9 steps back, and they do that 10 years in a row, it's still 10 steps forward.
Right.
So they're willing to be patient. So when this bill, AB 84, has been amended several times, each time it's scaled back a little bit to try to appease enough people so that they can get it through.
So this is sort of a bunny trail, but do you suppose the reason to be in favor of people who come into the country who didn't come in the right way is that this supplies the students for public schools so that they're keeping their enrollment up in the midst of people leaving?
I would have to say, yeah, I think there's probably a lot of that, because otherwise, where are the numbers coming from that they're able to maintain what they do have? Because there's been a tremendous amount of families. I mean, if you look at the numbers of people that are leaving California, and you look at who those people are. It's a lot of families with kids that are school age. So those people leaving are families with school age kids. The numbers in schools are dropping, but not enough to account for that. So they're coming from somewhere. And I think that you hit the nail on the head. Yeah.
There was a joke starting back in 2020 that U-Haul gave Gavin Newsom their Employee of the Year award because they had their revenues stepped up. And at the time, I remember thinking, well, he's doing his part to get people to want to leave public education as teachers and as students. And that's funny. That's a ha-ha moment. But it's very, very insidious.
Yeah.
Because it's almost as if, and you would know this better than I, that if there are a group of people who are somewhere in a dark closet somewhere going, what can we do to destroy the family? What can we do to attack Christians? And I don't think you're a conspiracy theorist, but because of where you work, there are probably things where you can see you're a conspiracy realist because you know this is going on.
Yeah, it is. The longer I work here, the more I'm willing to believe stuff that I probably wouldn't have before I started here. And I think there's a lot of groups of people behind the scenes that are making a lot of decisions and having an impact on a lot of the everyday life things that impact our ability to function in society, whether it's economically or whether it's things like, how are the schools going to function?
Right. And when you see all the things that happen at school board meetings, when people actually say, we don't want this, this is not what we're signed up for, oftentimes those parents are silenced. And we've seen in some cases arrested because they dared to object to something which, let's face it, Nathan, 30 years ago, people would be saying, what?
Yeah.
You're having a discussion absolutely. About this?
Yeah. That's so true. Yeah. And it's interesting how the discussions at the Capitol in hearings or in floor sessions, those discussions, it's shocking what things we're not talking about with bills going through. I mean, you mentioned all the legislation that comes through here in Sacramento. There's about 3,000 bills on average every year that are introduced, and they go through all these amendments, and there's so many different processes that they go through. And then as they go through that process, all of these issues come up that I'm thinking, why aren't we talking about? There's this ID card bill where they're wanting to publish more information about how students can get counseling for if they are considering what gender they might feel and whether they should get surgery or what they should think about this. And they want every child in California to have access to counseling without their parents' consent or knowledge about how to think about this. And the counseling is coming from an LGBT activist organization known as the Trevor Project. And so what do you do with the fact that as this moves through the process, there's so many elements of this that we certainly, you and I, would talk about and raise questions, but there's so many conversations that are not happening when it comes to this. And it's crazy how, you know, when we talk about protecting the family, that a lot of important things that need to happen in order to protect the family or things that really ought to not be happening, that's not even part of the conversation. It's more technical stuff or how are we going to make this work smoothly? Because, well, there might be some glitches along the way. Well, why is that the conversation we're having?
Right. You know, it's interesting. Very few people will take a job hoping that their job becomes unnecessary. I would say, based on where we are right now, your job is not likely to become unnecessary. Would you agree that the function that you serve isn't so much to reform public education, but to have your finger in the dike, but you realize it's got to be taken down, it's got to be demolished, because how can you fix something that at its root right now is meant to take control of children from their families?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that it is very much a situation of, we look at the public school system in California. We're the biggest state. We have the biggest public school structure in the nation. And we've got the largest number of kids in that system that are being controlled, and their minds are being filled with stuff that is completely not based on truth. And it's based on politics. It's based on a man-centered worldview. And it's not a system where you can look at the system and engage with the system and work to reform that and right the ship. The ship is taking itself under. It's pulling itself under the waves. And so when you look at that, you realize there are people constantly scrambling in the state capitol for how to solve this small problem or this small problem with the public school system.
Right.
But there's no big vision for how to even fix it from their own perspective. They know that it's kind of going under. And so whether you are looking at it from a Christian worldview or not, you have to acknowledge that the system is imploding on itself. But that aside, we have to look at what are our options for pursuing a Christian worldview. And first of all, don't put our kids in that system, that's for sure. But also when we are looking at voting and getting involved in government, we need to recognize, yeah, fixing that system is not the answer. It's coming up with a bigger picture solution to America's children, California's children, God's children that he's entrusted to parents.
Exactly. Okay, so that was the least known about the recent bills. The one that got lots of press eventually, I don't know at the outset if it did, was AB 495.
Yeah.
Explain how that bill was written, what the response has been, what the implications of it are, etc.
I'm glad we're talking about this now. It's moved through the legislature and has had a couple of amendments. Right now, as it stands, AB 495 takes a piece of code that is already badly written and could be misused easily and makes it worse. It opens this, there's a crack that allows people to abuse it, and this bill makes the crack wider. So what is that? It allows somebody to fill out a form, and by filling out this form, they're saying, I have been given the authority to take control of a child and make decisions for this child, whether it's medical decisions or education decisions. There's a range of things that this person can do. And that range changes depending on what type of relationship that person has or claims to have. And the only thing that they have to do in order to use this form to exert authority over a child that is or is not appropriately under their authority is they have to check a box that says either, there's two boxes. They can check the box that says, I have permission from the parents to have authority over this child, or I tried to reach the parents and I couldn't get a hold of them.
Okay, so I'm going to just stop you there.
Yeah.
Authorization. What makes, you know, I know it's downloading a form online. Mm-hmm. I know that there's no background check required. I'm not even sure you have to show citizenship, but maybe you do. Who authorizes this? Is this self-authorization?
It really is. And I've asked a few attorneys that question too, because I was so baffled by it. The fact is that somebody with this form can take it to a school or to a, and this form is already in current law, but this bill, AB 495, expands who can use it, who's allowed to use this for taking authority over a child.
Who was it previously giving authority to?
So it was previously giving authority to a much smaller range of relatives.
Grandparents, aunts and uncles, cousins.
Yes. Yes. That's about what it was. It was pretty narrow. And this expands it to very distant relatives and also non-relatives in a mentorship relationship. Which,
so could a mentorship relationship be a coach, a counselor at school, somebody's mother or father who you go to their house to a lot for snacks after school?
Absolutely. I'm sure that it could be easily argued that because it's not defined at all in the code. So with these undefined terms, somebody could make that argument. And I think those that you just listed are extremely reasonable for somebody to argue based on the wording that's in the bill.
Okay. So you ask yourself the question, why? Like, what would be the reason to do this? Right. So I could see scenarios where you have a custody dispute and mm-hmm. somebody gets somebody to be the mentor or the friend, and now the child is removed. There is a logic that the author of the bill said as to why she proposed it. And it was such good intentions that she had, and we know what it says about the road to hell. What were her good intentions?
So her good intentions that she still seems to be stating are that when children find themselves in the situation of not being able to get to their parents, children have missing parents, essentially. And her stated situation, what she's talking about, and her claim that that's who this bill applies to, is children whose parents have been detained or deported by ICE. Parents that are not in the country with any paperwork, and they're getting questioned or held or are being sent out of the country or have been sent out of the country back to their country of origin. And the children are left sort of just without a parent. The kids are left without a caretaker, and the kids are, maybe they're with grandma, or maybe they're with somebody else that they were at the friend's house. Like you were talking about, a friend's house who they've spent lots of time with and who maybe regularly picks them up from school. Maybe they carpool and take turns carpooling or whatever. They're with these other people, and all of a sudden their parents are inaccessible. And so somebody is trying to legitimately enroll them in school, or perhaps help them get emergency medical care for some reason, because the child is hurt and the parents are missing. So there, like you said, there's a legitimate reason for somebody to want to try to solve a problem. But unfortunately, this way of solving that problem is extremely dangerous, because you're opening wide a chasm of options for people to take authority over a child and do all sorts of things that were never intended by the parents. That right. The parents never wanted.
So just because I don't really have details on this, if parents are being detained by ICE, are they given the option to say, well, I've got some kids, and who's going to take care of my kids? Can they come back with me? Can I take my kids back with me if I'm being deported? Is this kind of like the arguments that were given for Roe v. Wade, that, you know, women were raped and the Norma McCovey was raped, but it turned out she wasn't raped? Is this a false flag, or is this a real situation that you have these children now who are roaming the streets homeless?
In general, my understanding is that this is not a regular problem brought on by either parents or somebody else. It's a situation where parents do have the right to take their kids with them back to their country, and that they choose not to sometimes, and which is sad. You know, I acknowledge that there's, you know, whatever country they're coming from, if it's so scary there to bring kids back to that they would rather leave them here without a parent, that's a really sad situation. And I suppose that that could happen, and that's terrible. But this bill and this code section is much broader than that. It doesn't actually say that it applies to that situation at all. That's not actually in the wording of the bill itself.
Interesting.
It's in the wording at the intro, at the beginning, where it says, here's our findings and here's our reason for this bill. But then when you get down to the bill itself, where the code language is, the language that's actually going into our code, it's not found anywhere in there at all.
Is there any built-in protection against somebody who protests this? I mean, for example, if you have a child who doesn't like mom or dad's rules and complains about it to a neighbor, a friend, a coach, a mentor, and now the mentor decides that the child is in an unhealthy situation, is there any provision in the bill for the parents to say, no, we object?
There is, in a sense, and I say that because the form that we talked about, the form actually says on it that if you lie on this form, you could go to prison, because it's a crime to perjure yourself on this form. So say somebody goes and uses this form. They find a kid. They take the kid to a school and enroll them in a school. Not with the parents' permission. The parents don't want them to do this, but they're there and they're doing it. And the parents could, after the fact, say, hey, what in the world is going on with my kid? Why are they in this school? I didn't enroll them there, and this person had no authority to do this. They never contacted me. And so, oh, this form was filled out and filed with the school? No, that was not appropriate. They never tried to contact me, or maybe when they did contact me, I said no. That situation could happen, in which case the parents could go after that other person, the perpetrator, and say, this person violated my parental rights and lied on this form. And so that person could then be prosecuted. And in that situation, maybe the kid's been in school for a day or maybe two or maybe several days before the parent found out if they were out of town or whatever. And then the parent goes after them. They address the situation. The person maybe gets put in jail. And then the child is back with the parents and the parents move on. And the worst that maybe happened in that situation was that the kid was enrolled in a public school and attended classes for a few days, which
okay.
I think that's bad by itself, but there's other
right.
worse situations.
So two questions. One, could this also apply then to say the child's going to now start living with me as opposed to he's going to go to this school or this, you know, I'm going to pay for certain lessons for him because he really wants it. Could it actually remove the child out of somebody's home?
So if the parents are missing, the child could be removed if somebody misuses this form without the parents' knowledge. It could remove them, but if as soon as the parent comes back into the picture and says, hey, no, I have authority over this, is my child, I want my child back, then that becomes a situation where the parent's authority supersedes the missing parent form.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. But it means the parents have to then get an attorney. They have to go to court. Now, is this decided in family court? Is this decided in civil court? Is it decided in criminal court?
As far as I know, the initial situation about who has authority over the child has to do with family court. But then the parents could go after them. I believe that it's a criminal offense to lie on that form. And if you're proving that, you're also perhaps proving that there was kidnapping that took place. So that's kind of a big deal, too. From my perspective, I mean, the public school enrollment issue is not nearly the worst case scenario for this type of thing, because I think that this opens the door to potentially have people taking a child and taking them to a medical provider and having perhaps a surgery done on a child. And there's potential. I say there's potential because there's a lot of confusing language that's undefined in this code section. And there are, I think, opportunities for somebody to go take a child and perhaps have gender treatment done and or sex change surgeries even. Those are pretty extreme, but I mean, those things, if a parent finds out a day or two later, and comes back and says, oh, this just happened while I was out of town, that's a much bigger deal and harder to reverse, I guess, for lack of a better term, than just school.
So is this bill specifically designed in a school setting that a child could be removed from school, or is it not limited to a school setting?
It's not limited. It's not limited to a school setting. A lot of people are talking about it in that context, and I suppose it could be used more there, theoretically, but it's not limited in the text of the bill that it has to take place there.
So I'm just the average person. Let's make me a well-meaning public school teacher, and somebody comes and presents me with this form. Am I obligated to release the child, or can I say, I want to get a hold of the parents. I want to check this is legal. Let's call in a police officer.
Yeah.
Or are they required to release the child.
Yeah, and I think this is where it puts school administrators and other people in a really awkward situation, because you are obligated when you get that form to follow what the form says. In other words, release the child to that person that's holding the form and not question them, not even allowed to ask for ID. It's ridiculous. It's so bizarre to me that this has gotten this far. It's requiring people, school administrators, healthcare professionals, to do what the person holding the form is saying you need to do.
So the person downloads the form, fills it out. It doesn't have to be approved by anybody. It just has to say, I promise I'm not telling a lie.
Right. Yeah. Under penalty of perjury, I understand I could go to jail if I'm lying, but I'm telling you this, so it must be true because I signed my name on this form.
It reminds me of how oftentimes now in courts, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Let's take out, so help me God. We're really saying, so help me.
Yeah.
And you know, we know people don't lie. I mean, they raise their hand and they swore not to do it. So religious leaders in California, parent groups, last week called people to show up at the Capitol in Sacramento and protest this. The day before they showed up, the bill was put in what's called suspension. Mm-hmm. Was this to avert and say, hey, you guys, I don't know why y'all showed up. It's really not a big deal. What was that strategy on their part? And then the second part of the question is, was the protest effective?
Yeah, great questions. So a lot of bills that cost money go into the suspense file. So it's not unusual for it to go into suspense file, but the timing was very suspicious. It went in the previous Thursday was when it was put onto a hearing for that Monday morning before the Tuesday pre-scheduled rally. So that timing was extremely unusual and very suspect from my perspective. So I definitely think that it was done to sort of try to pull the rug out from underneath the rally that was set for Tuesday. Some people did testify on this bill on the Monday morning as it was being heard. I don't know if fewer people came to the rally or not, but there were still a whole bunch of people there. I'm not sure of an exact number. Probably somewhere between 1,500, 2,000, maybe more. But there were a great number of people. And I do think that it was effective in the sense that people saw that crowd of people. Mm-hmm. And that couldn't be ignored. And in addition to that, a group of those people went to a training and actually visited every legislator's office with a packet of information about the bill and why they opposed it. Which I think both of those things working together can be really impactful. I tend to focus more on the office visits, but really both of them working hand in hand can have a good impact. And also making sure that legislators hear directly from people and that their offices get visited is really important, because they need to know that we're real people and that we care about our families and that this bill is concerning to us and that we're not dumb. We're not misinformed, which is very common that people get labeled as misinformed in order to sort of poo-poo their concerns and push them aside. But this, I think, was done well. There were quite a number of attorneys that actually spoke at this rally, right, and they expressed very clear concerns. And I think that legislators heard. I mean, the bottom line question is, will this bill pass, right? So this bill, together with AB 84, both of them are in the same suspense file, and they're waiting for Friday will be an announcement from this committee of which bills came out of the suspense file. It's a committee hearing where they hear the suspense file bills. It's not really a hearing, because a hearing is where people testify and people are heard. I call it a telling, because where they hear the suspense file, it's just somebody reading a report for a couple of hours of what happened to each of the hundreds of bills that are on this list and what they already voted on. There's no votes that take place. They just announce that they already voted on them.
How do we know which of the suspense bills make it to being passed or not?
That will be announced by the Appropriations Committee. The Senate Appropriations Committee will release a report that will show which direction the bills went. and then you'll be able to look it up online on the legislative website. What bills passed and what bills were held in committee. They can pass bills as amended. They can make behind the scenes decisions on wording. So they could amend a bill and get it passed out of that committee as well. And they can hold it in committee even through next year, since this is the first half of the legislative session and we have a 2-year session here. They can hold it in that committee, in that suspense file, throughout next year as well, and then pull it out and pass it to the floor at any point next year as well. So it could pass out of the committee on Friday, or it could stay in that committee and we not know what's happening with it for a long time. So
it could pass out of committee, and then you and people like you would have to read it to see how it was changed, because right. They could change the wording. And then the next step is the governor has to sign it.
The governor would have to sign it, but it does have to go to the whole floor of the Senate chamber as well. So the Appropriations Committee is a subset of the California State Senate. There's 40 state senators. If it does come out of the Appropriations Committee, it would go to the full 40 state senators. So that's one of the reasons that I'm encouraging people to call their state senator that represents them, because the next step is for the full Senate to vote on that bill.
So by the time this airs, it's likely that what we've just talked about is in the past.
Okay.
Okay. And so the best way for people to find out the status would be to go where?
So on the legislative website, if you go to leginfo.legislature.ca.gov, you will find a window where you can type in the bill number, AB495. And you type in that bill number, and you will find what the latest updates are right from the state legislator's website.
Okay.
You can also get updates from my website if you go to fpmca.org and click on our bill tracker page. We'll have updates on 495 as well.
One prominent minister in Southern California made the outrageous statement, or maybe not so outrageous, if this bill passes, I suggest Christian families leave California. Do you think that was hyperbole, or do you think that he was not overstating the case?
I don't know. He may believe that that's what parents should do. I don't think so. I think we should stay and fight this. And I think that if this passes, one of the interesting things about this bill is that it's brought to light a code section that a number of attorney organizations have looked at it recently and said, this looks unconstitutional. And so this bill now exacerbates the problem that was already there and makes this new code section, if it passes, extremely unconstitutional, because it violates a fundamental right of parents to direct the care and custody of their children. And that's a violation of the U.S. Constitution, not just California. So there's a number of attorney groups that are already planning on how to fight this in the courts. And so it could very well be stayed by a judge before it even goes into effect, and it could be reversed. So we don't know exactly how this would be put into effect ultimately. If it does pass and get signed into law by the governor, we don't know if it's going to be paused by the courts or even overthrown by the federal Supreme Court or a district court. So it's not time to move out of California.
Okay. I mentioned earlier that you look at all sorts of bills. As it currently stands, either with the charter school bill or the AB 495, is there any direct effect it could have on Christian homeschooling families?
I would say that AB 84, the charter school bill, doesn't have any specific language in it that directly affects private homeschool families. If there is a Christian family that is using a charter school, it will probably affect them. Depending on, again, how the bill looks when it gets passed out, it could have a pretty significant impact on how their relationship with the charter school works with those vendors and what that looks like. It's possible that they won't be able to use the same people, the same teachers, the same vendors. And if that means they don't get to use the same piano teacher they've used for a long time, then that's the way the law is. They might have to start paying out of pocket for those things. In terms of 495, I think it could just as well impact a privately homeschooling family as a charter homeschool family, or any other family in California that has school-age children or children of any age, because that bill does not discriminate on where your kid is in school or what your faith is. It doesn't discriminate at all. It's just a bill about children. So both of those have a potential to impact homeschool families. As far as AB 84, AB 84 could have a potential impact that would have repercussions sort of as a domino effect as well, because of how the infrastructure of tutors work in California through the charter school laws right now. Sometimes students in private homeschool families or even private campus schools are able to work with certain tutors at a certain price because of the way that the charter school laws are written, and people make certain amounts of money through that, and then they offer services to private homeschool families for a different price, possibly a lower price. So if this passes, all of this is sort of up in the air. And so it could change everything.
All right. So now I want to get into something that I think probably is most important in terms of those who deem themselves being faithful. And I'll just give you a little story. I ran into a woman that I knew 30 years ago, and she happened to have a store that I would frequent. And we were like, oh, wow, you remember me? We were talking about it. And she was telling me that she now works with homeschooling families to help them. And I thought, that's wonderful, you know, because a lot of people start homeschooling and they need some guidance. Well, it wasn't too long into our conversation where I discovered she was actually an employee of the state, and she helped administer the funds. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, but people can benefit so much. Of course, they can't use any of the money for religious purposes. So you could get sports lessons, you could get music lessons, you could be part of a choir, you could be part of a band, you could be part of a soccer, I mean, you could be part of everything, so long as it's not Christian. Would all those people fall under the vendor law?
Yes, if it's part of a charter school, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So I recently posted something on one of my Facebook pages about the mousetrap and the cheese and how homeschooling families are being lured by, wow, I have four kids, I'm homeschooling, I can get so much money per child. Do you think they have not really considered whether or not that they're selling their birthright?
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it sounds intense to put it that way, but it's very real. When you look at the education options that we have in California, I mean, we do have a lot of options. It's not like we're forced into one box. And a lot of people think or feel that they are forced into one box, but we have a lot of education options in California. Some of those options are public options. Some of them are private. You know, you have the traditional public schools and you have the charter schools, and then you have various programs within those that might give you an at-home option or a non-classroom-based option. But there's a bunch of private options too. And the significant thing that's a difference between the public and private options, you know, in private, you can have a campus private school, you can have a private school administrative program or a private school satellite program that oversees multiple homeschool families, or you could have a family that files their own private school affidavit and is their own private school. All of those are private. And so they're very separate from the public school options, whether it's a traditional or a charter. And the big difference between those two is, at least from the constitutional perspective, is that the California State Constitution says that you can't teach religious instruction with any state money. So all of those schools that are public, like you were saying, they can't be Christian. They can't teach Christian. They can't read Christian. They can't use Christian materials or teaching. And so there's a significant difference there. If you are Christian and you want to give your child a Christian education, that's not an option. You have to go on the private route. But there's another element to this that's really interesting. I couldn't help but think of it when you said, you know, sell your birthright, because there's an element between those two that's different that has to do with state data, state-controlled data. If your child is enrolled in one of those public school options, regardless of which one it is, if your option that your kid is in receives government money, your kids' school records are held in a state computer in Sacramento. If your kid is in a private school, you can have those records on hard copy and never online anywhere. It depends on how your school runs the records. But if you're privately homeschooling or if you're in a private school that uses hard copy paper, that's as far as your records ever go. And your child is not answering to the state. Your child's education is not answering to the state. It's answering to whoever is running that school. And whether it's a church that's running the school, whether it's parents running their own school, that's who you would answer to for that education. And ultimately, from my perspective, when I look at all of these different options, everybody is ultimately going to answer to God for education. It doesn't matter what program you're in. The people right. that are running those programs are going to answer to God one way or another. And so parents have the obligation to be aware of that, and they have the responsibility to make the best choice for their kids. And they can in California.
Right. I figure you're about the age of my children. Okay. So your parents and I and my husband were homeschooling back in the day. We didn't have these options of, hey, we'll give you some money and you can do this, that, and the other thing. In a lot of ways, these people are more bought than the people who actually enrolled their children because they're making a bargain. And I try to explain to people, if every child in the state of California, you probably know the numbers. How much does a school get for every child who sits at a desk? Do you know that number?
It's somewhere between 17 and 23,000, depending on the district, but yeah.
Okay, so that's how much they're going to get. So you come along and you want to homeschool and they say, we'll give you $2,500. You're just bargaining. You just did a negotiation and you didn't even end up that well with it, because if they're going to get 17,000 per child right. and you just deleted what they $2,500. So you're really selling your soul. And I think that was not a temptation. I'm not saying people wouldn't have fallen for the temptation, but they hadn't figured it out yet that we're losing a lot of people to this avenue. So here's the question. Do you think homeschooling today is stronger or less strong than when you were being homeschooled?
That's a great question. If you look at, it depends on how you define homeschooling, probably. Private homeschool families, I think, are very dedicated today. And when I was growing up, pre-charter era, there wasn't that temptation like you're talking about. But once the charters started coming in, you started to see the divide and you started to see people going one way and some people going the other way. People staying private and staying in control of their children's education, and other people taking the funds and saying, well, I'm willing to sacrifice a little bit to submit to the state to get that money to make it easier. I mean, you still see the same division, but I think it's a little bit harder in today's world to stay private. Because of whether it's economic concerns, it's probably harder to live economically today than it was, especially on one income compared to, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And it's certainly harder now to be hearing all the time, hey, why don't you just join this and you'll get $2,500 or a free computer or free horseback riding lessons or whatever the thing is that somebody is trying to encourage you to get for free.
When I had this conversation with the woman and I found out about it, I said, so part of the state is paying you to negotiate this deal. And she got very red in the face and everything else. And our conversation quickly ended. But when all was said and done, it came down to the fact that once I realized how many people are co-opted, and the thing about co-opting people, they're much easier to control.
Yeah, that's so true. And that bargaining, unfortunately, it's a very big part of our education culture in California. And it's sad to see how much of it is happening at the state level. But on a case-by-case basis, parent by parent, the state is offering this carrot and saying, come on over here, and luring people into this system that really has a anti-God mentality, that has an education that is not at all honoring to God. It is not fulfilling God's even definition of education or getting wisdom.
Right. So when you talk about the things that these payouts, these buyouts will allow people to do, that gives an assumption that there are areas of life that shouldn't be governed by God's word.
Right.
So I guess so long as the horse, if it's horseback riding lessons, isn't a Christian horse, that would be okay. But if you go to somebody who's going to basically instill and say, well, biblically, this is how you should treat an animal because the Bible says blah. So in essence, if it were really doubled down on, you could go nowhere, because people think that the worst part about public education is the bad stuff. They think drag queen story hours. They think right. transgender. But they miss the fact that children are not being taught the truth.
Right. Yeah. The big thing is the absence of the truth. It's the foundation for everything they're being taught is no foundation at all. It's just mush. It's the sand that was under that house that Jesus talked about. And when you look at the difference between a Christian education and a non-Christian education, it's either you have truth or you don't. Everything goes in the public school system. They don't even
care. Well, almost everything. Almost everything.
Everything but truth.
Yes.
You can't assign a truth value. Yes, yes.
All right. So back in the day, you worked with Roy. And in the previous podcast, again, which I hope people listen to, you said you kind of came in wet behind the ears and some experience and some mentoring and some perspectives. You realized that you were going to be in this for the long haul. And I always appreciate people who have families who are in this fight, because regardless of anything else, you're not doing this just out of the goodness of your heart. You've got kids and you have the prospect of grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Do you have people now that are eager and presenting themselves to say, I want to do what you're doing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's an important one in order to continue this work to the next generations. I think my desire is to see this work continue on. Like you said earlier, it's not exactly a job where I'm working myself out of one. It's going to be here. So I do have young people that we are training. My kids are certainly involved. My oldest daughter works here at my office, and she helps manage some of the interns as well as helps with a government class that I teach. We have students that come to the government class, homeschool students, whether they take it in person or online. They will learn about government. They will learn about the legislative process, specifically here in California. And I use the government class to sort of train advocates, because I want them coming out the other side of it, not just with a Christian perspective on government, but also a practical ability to influence the legislature here in California. It's something that I know something about, and I'm able to pass that on. So I make the most of that time to do that. And that has turned into a sort of a funnel to bring kids into an internship program. Some interns are in person, some interns are remote, but those interns are turning into employees. And I have some part-time people that are learning, that are helping, that are making a difference to even now impact the legislature. And I'm hopeful that some of those will stick around for the long term.
So how do people find you? Is it that parents are saying, my kids are interested, I want to do this? Do they fund their children being interns with you the same way parents might fund college expenses?
So internships, typically the parents will send their kids, or I have done where students need an internship to complete their college requirements. And so they'll come here and do an internship, whether it's 6 or 10 weeks or whatever, and do an internship, get college credit for it, and then maybe stick around or maybe move on to something else. But yeah, the internships, whether it's a high school intern or a high school graduate intern, they will start out as an unpaid intern for the most part, and then kind of go from there depending on their skills, their interest, and their fit here.
Do you sort of put them to work as soon as you can?
Oh, yeah.
Do you offer scholarships for people? In other words, let's say they're people like me. I'm no longer homeschooling children directly. and we wanted to provide scholarship funds so that somebody who was qualified and willing, but not necessarily able, could participate. Do you have a setup like that, or would you entertain a setup like that?
Yes, I do that occasionally for both the government class and interns. It's a case-by-case basis, and a lot of it depends on kind of where we are financially. Because we're a nonprofit, we rely on donors to make that happen. So definitely interested in continuing that, because I really think that not only for continuing the work here in our ministry, our organization, but getting this way of thinking about, you know, the biblical perspective on government and the ability to impact government in our culture today, I think that's so important, and there's a lot of value there. So I am trying to grow that in our organization, to grow that mentorship, that training, and that internship program.
So as I said earlier, what happens in California sort of moves east. You wouldn't be upset if this model moved east.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Well, before we go, once again, tell people how they might get in touch with you and explore all the things, including maybe they want their children involved in your government class.
Sure. Yeah. All that is available on our website. Again, I'm Nathan Pierce, and you can find out more about our internship program on our website, Family Protection Ministries. The website is fpmca.org, fpmca.org.
Which would stand for Family Protection Ministries, California.
Correct. Yes.
All right. Well, like I said, maybe we all wish that God would work it out immediately, that you'd be out of a job. And we neither one of us anticipate that's going to happen anytime soon. Like I always tell people, Moses never really knew that the Red Sea would part until he got there.
That's
right. He didn't have a guarantee. He didn't have a promise. He just had to get there. So we're not saying that God can't do a mighty work, but we certainly hope that faithful Christians understand that obedience brings blessing, not just wishful thinking.
Right. One step at a time.
Yes, indeed. All right. Listeners, outofthequestionpodcast@gmail.com is how you reach us. And I look forward to talking with you next time.
Thanks for listening to Out of the Question. For more information on this and other topics, please visit calcedon.edu.